This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello there, and welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Since U.S. President Donald Trump unveiled his deal of the century last week, the Middle East peace deal, tensions between Israelis and Palestinians, or Israelis and Arabs, have increased, including a series of terrorist attacks in Jerusalem. For this story, we'll turn to our man there in that city, Brent.
Yeah, on Thursday, there were three separate attacks inside Israel. The first of those came early Thursday morning when you had a car ramming attack taking place in West Jerusalem where soldiers were hit. 12 soldiers were hit by a car that veered onto a white sedan that veered onto the side of the pavement. And one of these is very seriously injured and still in hospital right now. The rest were injured, but some of them have been released. And then shortly after that, there was a shooting attack that took place just outside at one of the gates of the old city on the eastern part of Jerusalem. And then it was 2 hours later, and you had another shooting attack taking place in the northern parts of the West Bank. And during this is really, we don't know why it necessarily happened on Thursday, but circumstantially, you could definitely say that this was in response to the deal of the century coming down by some Arabs that didn't like it. The day before, Hamas put out a statement where they did encourage confrontation against the occupation as they see it. Because of the deal of the century and because of a death of a Palestinian rock thrower the day before that was rioting against the IDF forces. But really what we've seen just over yesterday because of this is really a shattering of a calm that's existed over the city for some time, especially this attack that took place in West Jerusalem by the first station. This is a popular destination for people, let's say those that are not accustomed to seeing terrorist attacks. It just happened less than a mile from my house. And so this is a place where I go all the time. This is a place where families are. This is a place where a lot of tourists, foreigners go because it's one of the places that is open on the Sabbath or even Sabbath afternoon. And so to hear about an attack like this, a car ramming in West Jerusalem and in a place that gets a lot of tourists, I think it would be shocking and probably jarring for a lot of Jerusalem's residents. And this is something that is important because it's easy to live in Jerusalem and not fear anything and feel completely safe because all the terrorist attacks really for the past year or so, 2 years, have taken place in East Jerusalem, in the West Bank, somewhere that's far off and you don't even think about it. And here is an attack that took place right where everyone, let's say a lot of people in Jerusalem over the past 6 months or even a couple of weeks had a memory of being in that location. And so this, I think, has rattled a lot of Israelis that there might be a stronger response to the deal of the century than perhaps was initially realized, because it did take a week or so for this to happen. The police force came out on Friday, more police were throughout the city. IDF was on high alert throughout the West Bank, and so they were trying to clamp down on any further spiraling out of control. So we'll see if there are other terrorist attacks that come from this as well.
The Palestinian group Fatah actually specifically blamed the peace plan for the increase in violence. They said that the plan created the atmosphere of escalation and tension.
Yeah, that's right. And they would say that because they don't like this peace plan, the Palestinian Authority. And so it is difficult to think about the motivations of these people that did it. Some of them were Israeli Arabs. Obviously, Hamas put out their statement, and so maybe there's some ties to Hamas. We don't know for sure just yet. But it seems to be so much more than circumstantial to have no attacks and then have three specific attacks, including attacks involving weapons. Like guns. And so this seems to be a response to that. But at the same time, I do feel like the response to this peace deal that President Trump has given hasn't been or perhaps won't be very upsetting to the masses of the Palestinians, because many of them, 44% of them, it's in a poll that was given early this week, actually favored the deal. There are just as many Arabs that want the peace deal as Israelis. And so that's probably not getting reported anywhere in the West. But there will be a contingent that don't want the deal to go through. And a lot of that, and there will be the leadership of Hamas and also Fatah that don't want the deal to go through as well. And so they will be trying to mobilize their supporters to attack Israel to try and shut down any type of peace deal.
Well, when you hear a poll like that, you can understand why Israeli and American leaders would be optimistic about the potential for Palestinians to actually come to accept this deal. They've left this four-year window to give them the opportunity to embrace it. Bible prophecy tells us that's not the direction it's going to take.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so important for our listeners to read our editor-in-chief's trumpet brief that came out yesterday, Will the Trump Peace Plan Bring Peace to Israel? It was very good for me to read, just to look at the prophecies, look what we know is going to happen, how there isn't going to be a wand that can be waved and producing, well, maybe not even a wand. This is a very specific plan, even a very specific plan that gives Palestine a state. This is the first plan that's actually going to give them a state with these type of borders. Even that is not going to produce this peace that many Palestinians and many Israelis actually want. They desire peace, many of them, but they don't know how to attain it without God's help. And so people really need to read this article about the peace deal and just zoom out and look at some of these prophecies. But I will say that it's my personal belief that even though we have had terrorist attacks over the past week, that this peace deal might actually produce a layer of calm for the near future in which there is a work to be done inside Judah by the trumpet staff, by Mr. Gerald Flurry. And so maybe this is providing us a little window to get more of a work done before we know that things are going to get a whole lot more difficult. And so peace is not going to come through this deal. It might buy a little bit of time. The problem with this deal is that Israel is negotiating with leadership that does not want Israel to exist going forward. They don't want a Jewish state, and so they're not going to ever accept a Jewish state next door to them. And the fact that Israel is negotiating with them to the point that they would give away 70% of the West Bank, it does foretell that this peace deal is not going to be successful.
Well, we will definitely put a link to that trumpet brief from Gerald Flurry in the show notes, as well as an article that Brent posted yesterday, Israel Rattled by Successive Terrorist Attacks. Go read those at thetrumpet.com to get the prophetic context of what's happening over there. Thank you very much for that report, Brent. The Wuhan coronavirus is continuing to spread, and it's beginning to have significant economic effects. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there's really quite a lot to get caught up on here. This is a fast-paced story, and it just seems to be getting more and more serious. But to start with, the official death count as of this morning is now 638 people. So the Wuhan coronavirus is claiming more and more lives, and the dead per day keeps getting higher as well, which shows that it has not peaked. And also, up until this week, all of the dead were inside mainland China. But now we've had one person killed in Hong Kong, one in the Philippines, and possibly one more in Dubai. So it's spilling over borders. And as of this morning, there are 31,500 confirmed to have been infected with it around the world. 12 of those cases are here in the United States. So some people are recovering from it. There are almost 1,800 now that have had it and then are confirmed to have recovered from it. But all of those are, it's also important to note that all of those figures for the infection rates and the deaths are only the official numbers. And there's quite a lot of evidence emerging that China might be significantly downplaying the true extent of this. But even if we just go with those official figures, the numbers are going in the wrong direction, and the virus is far from contained. And there are all kinds of geopolitical effects that this is having around the world, but the main one is that by shutting down the workshop of the world, which is what China really is in some ways, it's actually flashing some warning signs for the entire global economy. Ambrose Evans Pritchard wrote about this in The Telegraph on Wednesday, and he pointed out that as of this week, two-thirds of the Chinese economy remains shut down, and over 80% of its manufacturing industry is closed. And for exporters, that's up at 90%. So this is just a huge part of China that's ground to a halt as a result of efforts to try to contain and quarantine the virus. And on Trumpet Hour last week, we made some comparisons to the new Wuhan coronavirus and the SARS epidemic that hit China back in 2003. And back then, China made up 4.5% of the world economy. So, you know, the outbreak of SARS did send ripples around the world, but it was nothing too serious. But now we've had about 17 years of remarkable growth from China. And at present, the Chinese economy makes up about 17% of the total global economy.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so it's, you know, about four times larger than when SARS hit, and it's far more integrated with countless other nations. So that means that this disease outbreak could really wreak havoc on economies around the world, and we're already seeing some major disruptions. Hyundai is the world's fifth largest car manufacturer, and they've closed all their factories at home in South Korea because they're not able to get the parts that they need from China. Even though they're fairly minor parts, even if it's just a little fastener or a bracket that you need, you can't finish the car. And then we're also seeing Fiat Chrysler in Europe. They're on the brink of shutting for similar reasons. Volkswagen, Toyota, General Motors, and Tesla, they've all really been struggling with a lot of their production operations. Crude oil prices around the world have dropped 20% since early January. That's the biggest shock to oil markets since the Lehman crisis.
And just because of reduced demand,
right,
within China.
Exactly. Yeah, reduced Chinese demand. And Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he makes a really interesting statement here. He says, quote, "There is no global economic safety margin. Both the U.S. Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank have already relaunched quantitative easing, a bizarre thing to do if the U.S. economy is really doing as well as President Trump claimed in his State of the Union address. Clearly, U.S. strength is a late-cycle illusion. Exhaustion has been masked by both a blast of monetary stimulus and a fiscal deficit near 5% of GDP. So, you know, I think he makes a good point that the global economy is fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't shut down China for very long without that really, you know, shutting down parts of the world. So if this virus isn't contained soon, we could begin seeing some serious effects worldwide.
That point about fragility is really interesting. We, you know, as much as the leaders of great nations feel like they're the ones shaping world events and that they're in control of, you know, the direction of the world, a little virus can disrupt all of these events in ways that we could not foresee. You know, the chances of this actually turning into something that has long-lasting geopolitical ramifications remains to be seen. You could see us recovering from this and so on. But the fact is that unforeseen events can throw things into a real tumult. And, you know, there's nothing that we can do about it. There's so many factors that are outside of the control of human beings that we just can't. We can't account for. It is interesting. There's some analysts that are saying, you know, this actually looks like it will be contained, say, within a few months, and have some interesting projections as to what might happen if that takes place.
Yeah, that's true. The timeline that some experts put this on say that it will be kind of stabilized by April with no new transmissions by May. And then that would set the summer up, especially for the United States, for quite a rebound. There's an Axios piece that says most economists predict the world will get back to business as usual by the summer and make up for lost time with accelerated economic growth in the second half of the year. And I think the amazing thing about that from the American perspective is what a boon that would be to President Trump's bid to be reelected. You know, he's really emphasized how the economy has done well under his tenure. And if he sees just this summer bump just before the November elections, that could be significant.
Well, Gerald Flory wrote about this in a Trumpet brief earlier this week, the spread of the coronavirus and other modern plagues, and just talks about Bible prophecies of how diseases will have major impacts on the world. And this discussion of geopolitical and economic effects is really quite fascinating. And I think you just can't help but take a second look and a more intense look at some of those prophecies that describe its impact on the world in the time ahead. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Another huge story this week, a far-right party in Germany had quite a landmark week, and it points to a troubling future for German politics. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
For the first time ever in Germany's post-war history, a far-right party helped elect the government of a German state. And this is a pretty big moment that came on Wednesday. We've talked about the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland, this far-right party, before in Germany. And until now, all of the other German parties have said, we won't work with you. You're too extreme. They've refused any coalition deals. Sending a message to voters, you know, don't vote for this party, vote for them, and they're not going to be able to form a government. They're not, it's a wasted vote. They're not going to be able to be part of the, they're not going to be able to set any rules. Well, that changed on Wednesday in the German state of Thuringia. So we've talked about this state before in the election there. They had a regional election back in October, and it was absolute paralysis. The far left, the Linke Party, the left party, the successor to Germany's East German Communist Party, they won that election with around 30% of the vote. And then the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD, this far right party, were in second place with a bit over 20%. To form any government had to have one of those two pretty extreme parties. None of the normal coalitions could work. And the way they ended up solving this deadlock on Wednesday was for Angela Merkel's party, the CDU, to work with the Alternative for Deutschland party and to vote in a candidate from a third party, the Free Democratic Party. So you had Angela Merkel's party cooperating, working hand in hand with the Alternative for Deutschland to make this happen. And this, like I said, that ends the this taboo. It breaks that taboo. And it stirred a lot of historical associations, because you go back to the 1930s and Thuringia, this same state, was one of the very first times that the Nazis were allowed into a state government as well. So you've got this history repeating itself. And then the AfD in Thuringia, it's one of the more extreme branches of the AfD as well. This is where they're led by Bernhard Hucke, who's basically said that Germany needs to get rid of its Holocaust memorials, that it needs to change the way it views its history, stop talking about the Holocaust. It's talking about Germany having a glorious 1,000-year future, kind of an obvious allusion to Hitler's idea of a 1,000-year Reich. So these were the people that Angela Merkel's party were getting in bed with. So that was on Wednesday. This caused outrage all across Germany and all across the world. It was a massive backlash. Angela Merkel herself was very critical of what her party did over there. There were big protests. The media was pretty much universal in its condemnation of what happened. And so Thomas Kemmerich, the guy that came to power with the help of this far-right party, he resigned in about 24 hours. So he had that job there as state premier for just about a day. And he's gone now because of that backlash. But this doesn't finish the story. You've still had now, you've given AfD voters the hope that maybe if they keep sticking to their guns, if they keep voting in the AfD, someone's going to cave, someone's going to cooperate with them. The people in the Angela Merkel's party in Thuringia, they were obviously wanting and willing to cooperate with the AfD, even if the National Party wasn't. But you've also got big implications for Germany's ruling coalition. There's still the potential, you know, this coalition is incredibly weak, incredibly fragile. And that's starting to shake as a result of what we saw in Thuringia. The left-wing party that's in that coalition has been threatening to talking about walking away from this coalition over this. They don't want to have any part in a coalition where one of their partners is doing deals with the AfD. It's also rebounded very negatively on the woman that Chancellor Angela Merkel has kind of brought up as her successor, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer. Kramp-Karrenbauer has come under a whole lot of criticism for allowing this to happen, for not being in control of her own party. And the potential is that she could go as a result of what happened. So it was a political earthquake on Wednesday, and we're still watching the aftershocks kind of reverberate around the country.
So there have been some comparisons with the way that the Nazi Party in the 30s kind of insinuated its way into German politics. It started, you know, on the fringe, and then it kind of grew over the course of a few elections and became the predominant party. I just wonder, with this situation, how much do you view this as a potential threat for, say, the AfD to take center stage? And how much is this just a reflection of Germans' willingness to, or their desire for those kinds of policies, but it's really going to be more of a mainstream figure, or maybe even a mainstream party that adopts some of those trends for its own platforms? You know, we've talked about this also being an effect of the rise of an AfD, as you have more centrist parties that are saying, well, we need to appeal to that segment of the voters that are going that direction and give them an alternative to the AfD.
Yeah, I think it will do both. I think you could see this boosting the AfD, and I think there are some polls, early polls, indicating they've now shot to being the number one most popular party in Thuringia. They at least claim that. So I think you could see it boosting their support. But at the same time, I think what Germany, this politics can be kind of hard to follow. You've got all of these different parties and all of these different coalitions, but Germany's politics wasn't always like that. You go back to the 80s, you go back to the 90s, and you had two big main parties that generally got around 40% of the vote, and a few more minor parties that played a much smaller role. Not this just whole smorgasbord of different groups of all roughly equal size that you have today. And I think Germany, you know, they want that stability. They want the stability that their system used to give them. Now, with all of the dissatisfaction that you have in Germany, you've got a system that's become unstable, that you've got the support dissipated in all these different groups, and suddenly you can have this crisis crop up where the AfD, a neo-Nazi party, brings somebody into government and they last for a day and they disappear again. You know, what I think this is going to really cause Germans to crave is something much more stable. Mm-hmm. And a strong leader, somebody not like Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer or Angela Merkel, but somebody who can bring some stability, who can bring some order, who can put the AfD in their place. I think some people are going to want somebody who will look and sound much more reasonable than the alternative for Deutschland is, just like you were saying. But I think this is just going to really increase Germany's desire for a strong leader at almost any cost. Even if it means adjusting some of the rules of the democracy or going a bit outside the traditional norms, but it'll boost this idea. We can't go on like this. We can't have another Angela Merkel. We can't let Angela Merkel's successor be someone who's broadly in her image. We need somebody to put some control in here. Otherwise, we're just going to keep having these fires and these different crises.
Well, that is quite interesting to contemplate, considering what we're expecting to happen there prophetically.
Yes, there's so many very detailed prophecies in the Bible that talk about a strong man in Germany. And I'd really like to point our listeners to Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry's cover article from the January Trumpet print, "Is Katie Zu Gutenberg About to Come to Power?" And what he does in that article is really zoom in on some of those prophecies in the Book of Daniel and just show how many details they show us about what is this strongman is going to be like and how he's going to come to power. And then you just see them, you see Germany being set up, the world events in Germany set this up so well, set Germany up in a perfect situation for a man described here to come to power. You know, these Bible verses talk about him coming in by flatteries, about manipulating the political system and not coming in the normal, legitimate way. They talk about him being a very crafty person, a very charismatic person. They absolutely talk about him being a strong leader, exactly the kind of person you could see Germany, the Germans rallying behind. But in that article, Mr. Flurry wrote, "Knowing that such political intrigue will occur makes the bureaucratic turmoil in Berlin, and we could add now Thuringia, important to watch. The government is shaky. The need for strong leadership is clear, but the path to achieve it is unknown. This prophesied leader may well exploit this frustration and confusion by rallying a coalition behind him and vaunting himself to power. This would take a lot of intelligence and calculation. It would require unusual skill to deceive people in high places with flattery, but the prophesied Daniel 8 man will do it magnificently." And he talks about how this man in the Bible, he's prophesied to have a lot in common with Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. But there are some differences as well. He is, you look at what the Bible says about him, and he is more subtle, more adept at deceiving people. And so you were talking a couple of minutes ago just about how there's the similarities with the 1930s, but some differences as well. And you see that in Bible prophecy too. This man isn't exactly identical to Adolf Hitler, and he'll probably come into power in a bit of a different way rather than smashing the system the way that the Nazis did. And in that article, Mr. Flurry shows how we think Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg, the former German defense minister, could well be that man, and he provides a lot of evidence for that. But that article is just a really great, it puts those prophecies under the microscope, and then you can see how detailed they're being fulfilled in the news today.
Well, fascinating stuff. We have an article up on the website right now by Josue Michel, "State Elections Reveal Germany's Instability." I would encourage our listeners to go check that out at thetrumpet.com. And of course, we'll link to that in our show notes for the program today. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Also, if you want more information about it, Stephen Flurry has been talking about this the last couple of days on his Trumpet Daily radio show. So you can go listen to his comments as well. Political instability and unpredictability is hitting countries all over the world, not just Germany, including America. This was a crazy week in American politics, and somehow it ended up being a very good week for President Trump and a really bad week for Democrats hoping to unseat him in November. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, now that the U.S. Senate has acquitted President Trump of impeachment charges, they did that on Wednesday, it looks like the Democrats are going to have to try to get rid of him the old-fashioned way and win the 2020 presidential election by getting people to vote for them, though that's off to a rocky start as well. The Iowa State caucus happened on Monday. That's the beginning of the Democratic presidential process to pick a candidate. It's been about 5 days now, and we're still not exactly sure who won that. It looks like it's a pretty close tie between Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders. And so I imagine they'll announce someone soon. It looks like Pete Buttigieg has a slight lead, so it seems like a lot of people are predicting that he will be the one who won that caucus. Although Bernie Sanders is already saying it doesn't count because he won the popular vote in the Iowa State caucus. Ironically, the Democrats run the Iowa State caucus in almost exactly the same way that the Constitution runs the Electoral College. Huh. So if Buttigieg wins,
flawed system,
if
obviously.
Buttigieg wins, we're all going to be waiting with bated breath for the DNC to come out and explain to Bernie Sanders that popular votes don't matter. But on the other hand, if Bernie Sanders has the most votes, he of all people should be fine if we redistribute some of his votes to the less fortunate candidates.
That's one way of looking at it. Yeah, it's hard. You couldn't make this up. This is, as it's been pointed out, this is the party that wants the government to run everything, and they have a hard time running an election.
Right. That is a good point. And there might be a little bit more to it than that as well, because it wasn't quite this bad last election, but Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton were also neck and neck in Iowa, and I think it came down to what they call a political coin toss. I don't know if they actually flip an actual coin, but it's kind of like a toss-up between the two. Mm-hmm. And Hillary Clinton won all 26 of those coin tosses, which statistically is impressive.
No, but there's clearly a lot of resistance within the Democratic Party to putting a candidate out front who is as radical as Bernie Sanders is.
Right. This Iowa thing, I mean, it could be them just being completely disorganized, but it might also be a little bit more of an authoritarian. It's like, well, we're going to keep counting the votes until we get the answer we want. Because the Democrats are in a bit of a tough position in that the most popular candidate in their party is a self-avowed socialist who has many self-avowed communists working for him. And he may be the most popular candidate in the Democratic Party, but no one expects him to do well with independents in a presidential election. So they're saying, like, oh, well, Bernie Sanders, maybe he could win the Democratic primary, but he can't win the general election. And so they've already had, I think NBC News had reported that someone overheard John Kerry in a hotel lobby talking about, like, well, I'm going to have to jump in this thing last minute if Biden goes down. And Politico saying that even Barack Obama is saying that he's like, well, I didn't want to get involved in the primary process. I wanted to wait till the general election, but I might have to speak up and say something if it's going to go for Sanders, because it's like, this is going to be a game, set, and match for Donald Trump if Bernie Sanders is the nominee. Mm-hmm. So they're in a tight spot. It's going to be a really divisive election, even within the Democratic Party, is that there's quite a bit of infighting between this more establishment wing, who realizes that Bernie Sanders probably can't win an election, and this socialist slash communist base that just has a pretty fiery zeal for putting Bernie Sanders in that position. But in the show notes, we can put our editor-in-chief's article, The Roots of America's Dangerous Turn Left, where he goes through scriptures in Ezekiel 7 about violence consuming the nation, that Ezekiel 7 says, like, make a chain for, like, one violent event happens after the other. But he puts that in context of, like, this revolution that wants to tear down America's political system. And you can, it's hard to know exactly how that's going to play out, but you can definitely see that infighting and that revolutionary spirit certainly occurring between Democrats and the Trump administration, but even starting to tear apart the old vestiges of the traditional Democratic Party itself.
Mm-hmm. Remarkable what's happening to the Democratic Party and to America. We'll definitely keep watching this coming year as we lead into that next presidential election. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, how Russia is upgrading its nuclear arsenal, Israel getting some support from some unlikely sources, America's severe spending addiction, and Britain's commitment to eliminating gasoline from every last car on its roads. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A recent article by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace highlights a troubling trend, particularly for Europe, and that is the fact that Russia is actively, even aggressively, upgrading its nuclear arsenal. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this report was published on January 29th, and it really goes into quite a lot of detail about the way Russia, under President Vladimir Putin, is updating all of those nuclear arsenals and just replacing older technology with cutting-edge, more lethal nuclear technology. It zooms in a little bit on the Boris Vestnik missile that Russia's been developing, and also some of the new intercontinental delivery systems, and it discusses the way Putin is really prioritizing nuclear modernization in large part to convince the world that Russia is still a great power to be reckoned with and, you know, feared and respected. And the report shows that even though Russia is under financial strain and having to tighten its belt and cut spending in some sectors, when it comes to military matters, that's, you know, that's a priority that they won't compromise with. That's something that Putin always finds a way to finance. And in the case of nuclear weaponry, he will do whatever is necessary to keep Russia's arsenals on the cutting edge.
Well, one of the points that the Carnegie Endowment brings out is just how troubling this is to Europe.
That's right. Yes, that's one of the points that they really emphasize, just how the European nations are alarmed by these developments. One section of it says, quote, "The Europeans are very concerned about Russia's nuclear modernization programs. Their concerns revolve more around new nuclear missiles to be deployed on European soil than the intercontinental systems that threaten the U.S. And so from there, it talks about Kaliningrad, which is a little Russian enclave right in between Poland and Lithuania. And we've talked on the show before about the nuclear-capable Iskander missiles that Russia has put there. So that has many European nations really on edge. And then the report also calls attention to Crimea, which was annexed by Russia only about 6 years ago. But the Russians have been busy building bases for Iskander missiles there. And this Carnegie report says, quote, "If Russia brings nuclear weapons into Crimea, it'll spark complex political, legal, and moral problems," end quote. And of course, it would mainly be, you know, the Ukrainians and other Eastern Europeans who are right there next to Crimea, right in the neighborhood, that would be the most threatened by this. So the trend, it really is frightening Europe.
Well, that's exactly what Gerald Fleury has said, is in some ways the primary outcome of the kind of aggressiveness that Vladimir Putin has repeatedly shown for his entire time in power.
That's right. Yes. The media typically plays up the U.S. angle, probably because of the legacy of the Cold War. It was always the Soviet Union versus the U.S. But Mr. Fleury has really said what we need to watch is Europe and how they respond to Russia's rise. He's written about that several times, placing it in the context of Bible prophecy. One of his landmark articles on this topic is from 2014, just after Russia annexed Crimea. And one part of it says, "We've been prophesying that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire." Mm. So, you know, many, many Europeans are still very alarmed by what happened with Crimea. They're very alarmed to see all this nuclear weapons modernization, and it is prompting them, especially if you think about Lithuania. They would stand no chance alone of standing up to Russia or even beginning to. But if they were unified with Germany and powerful nations, mm-hmm. then they would do much better.
Very interesting. The Crimean crisis is reshaping Europe. That article by Gerald Fleury. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. We also have an article up on the website by Rufaro Manyepa on this very subject. The title of that article, "Russia is Upgrading Its Nuclear Weapons." So you can watch for that on thetrumpet.com as well. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. After the U.S. unveiled its peace plan for the Middle East, there was a call by some Arab states to show its displeasure by pulling back from ties to Israel. Intriguingly, though, some other states did precisely the opposite. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Israel, underneath the leadership of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, has been searching for many friends over the past few years. And of note, these have been friends in the Arab world and particularly friends in North Africa. And just this past week, we saw the Prime Minister make a trip to Uganda, which does have relatively good ties with Israel. But while there, the Prime Minister met with the new leader of Sudan, This is a country that is renowned for its anti-Israel stance under Bashir, who was removed from power, I guess it was about a year and a half ago now. They were an Iranian ally. Israel has bombed Sudan many times as it was used as a transit point for Iranian weapons en route to Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And yet this past week, we have seen with this meeting with the prime minister and the leader of Sudan, an outward sign that ties with that nation are warming. And this comes after Israel has reached out to Chad, and before that, it's reached out to, I think it has ties with Senegal, it has ties with other North African states. We know it has a peace agreement with Egypt, and which is just really interesting to see how Israel, even as it is painted as, especially by the Western media, as a nation with no friends in the region, its ties, especially with North African nations, are increasing to a degree that we have not seen.
I read several reports about just how much even Palestinians would prefer to live under an Israeli administration rather than a Palestinian administration, that you actually have Arabs in Israel who are opposed to the deal, not because it's not favorable to Palestinians, but because it's not favorable enough to Israel. It is interesting how much you have this kind of backlash against this United Arab Front that is opposed to Israel. What do you make of that? What do you make of Israel's success in these areas?
Yeah, well, this is something Israel has worked at for some time, but it definitely is connected to the United States for sure. Whether it be Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, who's currently right now still on the U.S. terrorism list, who's still facing sanctions from the United States, their relationship with the United States is paramount to them because of the trade that could happen, and also because everyone is still scared in the region of Iran and Iran's march, be it in Yemen or Syria or elsewhere. And so there is this mutual understanding that if these Arab states do befriend Israel, they will be falling on side of the Trump administration, and they'll be able to form a front against Iran's drive. It's interesting how it's painted in the Western media, how especially with underneath the Obama administration, that, you know, if only we reached out to Iran, everything would be rosy. Everyone in the Middle East knows, these nations in the Middle East know, that Iran is the leading destabilizing actor that threatens, whether it be Jordan, Saudi Arabia, or these other nations. It's not Israel. And so that the whole Palestinian-Israeli peace or Palestinian-Israeli problem falls into the background, and the paramount importance is how to deal with Iran. That is what the Arab states and even North African states are worried about. And so that's why they're one of the reasons why they are becoming closer to Israel because of that. In terms of the peace deal and what's happening with the Palestinians, what you were talking about is there are actually riots in the northern West Bank area and areas that are adjacent to, let's say, the areas that Israel would control in the event that this peace deal goes through. These Palestinians are rioting because they want to be under Israeli leadership. They enjoy the freedoms under Israeli leadership. They don't want to fall under dictatorial Arab rule on a future Palestinian state. And so, yes, they don't like the deal, but not because it doesn't give them enough. It's because they would rather stay in Israel. And so you really have to be cautious at the reporting that you listen to, because the collective response to the Trump peace deal has been more positive in the Arab world and in Israel. Let's say that there is no collective angry response against the peace deal. A wholesale response. There are many people that would favor it, many Arabs that would favor it. But really, most of the Arab world now does not see the primary importance of their foreign policy being Arab-Israeli peace. They've got other bigger fish to fry.
So we talk about the Psalm 83 alliance of nations that are kind of forming something of an anti-Iran alliance. What's interesting about what you're seeing here is that it is taking on at least something of a pro-Israel flavor. But you look at the the prophecy in Psalm 83, and it's very anti-Israel.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. I mean, what Mr. Fleury, our editor-in-chief, has talked about, Mr. Gerald Fleury, is how the Psalm 83 alliance is going to come together really at the demise of the Iranian kingdom. Right now, you see the Iran rising, and you see all the Psalm 83 alliance nations, such as Saudi Arabia, such as Turkey eventually will be with this group, the Gulf states. And right now, they're against Iran. And with Israel, because Israel is on board with the United States in its anti-Iranian action. But once the Iranian threat is removed, which will happen, that is when the Psalm 83 alliance comes together in that case, not against Iran. Iran is now gone. They've been dealt with. And you see them coming together in a more anti-Israel flavor. Well, not just flavor, but they are blatantly anti-Israel at that point. And so that shows us this, that these relationships that Israel is developing, these close ties that Israel is developing with these Arab states that happen to be part of the Psalm 83 alliance, it is all a relationship of convenience because they are scared of Iran more. But when Iran is removed out of the picture, then their true colors will be seen. And that is definitely a warning for the state of Israel to understand that these are not friends. These are nations that are making the best of the situation because they're scared of Iran.
Thank you for that, Brent. He is planning to write about this subject this coming week. You can watch for his article at thetrumpet.com. Donald Trump is enjoying record high job approval ratings, but it has meant completely abandoning what has been a pillar of conservatism in America, and that is economic discipline. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, President Trump spoke quite a lot about how fast the economy is growing in his State of the Union speech this week. And he's right, the economy is growing fast. But as fast as it's growing, it's not growing quite as fast as the federal debt. The Congressional Budget Office released an annual report this year giving economic projections for the next decade. And its trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see. They're projecting that by 2030, the public debt is going to be 80% of the nation's entire gross domestic product. Now, the total debt's already 102% of gross domestic product, but that includes all the money the government has borrowed from the Social Security Fund as well. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like borrowing from your own savings account. So some economists count that in the debt to GDP ratio. Some economists don't.
Well, it's not exactly a savings account if it's money that's actually meant to be paid out to someone.
Right. I guess they've borrowed from their own IOUs.
Right. Yeah.
They're like this money because it's not like there's a vault someplace with all the Social Security money.
Right.
It's just kind of that, like, well, 10 years from now, people are going to be paying us Social Security that we're going to give to retirees, but we've actually already borrowed the money that they haven't given us yet,
right,
to pay the retirees. So that's why
they're treating it like a savings account. But
that's why many economists say no. The real debt to GDP ratio is we've borrowed 102% of our GDP. The public debt is just what we owe people outside the government, and even that's 80% of GDP.
Yeah, in today's news report from Richard and just our news bureau, there was this article from the Mises Institute, the State of the Union, an annual reminder of inevitable default, and it's talking about just how much how thoroughly the Trump administration has abandoned the idea of fiscal responsibility. It actually quotes him as telling donors earlier this year, who cares about the budget? Like he wants to create this sense of, you know, everything is going up and up and up, no matter what cost that might have in terms of the long-term financial viability of the nation.
Right. Well, President Trump's right that in an election year, there's not many people who care about the budget. So it's definitely not a vote getter to bring up.
Yeah.
But the comment's a very shameful comment because anyone who lives someplace knows that There's rent to pay and there's food to buy, and you need to care about a budget, and a nation needs to care about a budget, same as a person needs to care about the budget. And apparently Mr. Trump hasn't spent much time going through this new congressional budget report, because they've crunched the numbers with all these debts, and they're saying that within the decade, we're going to be spending 60% of all federal revenue on just health care and Social Security, and another 10% on the interest of the debt we already have. So that's 70% of our entire budget on health care, Social Security, and interest payments, which means everything else is going to have to be drastically cut back to this 30%, including the military. That's one of the articles we can put in the show notes, is actually something I wrote a year, maybe a little more than a year ago, titled "Can America Afford Its Military?" Those numbers might be a little dated because it was based off a previous congressional budget report, but it's showing that, like, at the way these trends are going, that so much money is going to interest payments on the debt and health care and Social Security, that you're not going to have anything left over for military spending and infrastructure and other things. It even brings up a verse in Micah 5. I'll actually just read it. It starts in Micah 5, verse 10. It says, "And it shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord, that I will cut off the horses in the midst of thee, and I will destroy your chariots. I will cut off the cities of the land and throw down your strongholds." Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong makes the point in the United States and Britain and Prophecy that that is a prophecy about sudden destruction, where America's the biggest military power in the world up until the point that it's not. And finances look like they're going to have a really big part to do in that.
Wow. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. One last story. America isn't the only nation putting itself in hot water financially. Britain's Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, finally got Brexit done, and this week he turned around and implemented a policy that could well single-handedly destroy Britain's economy. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, the government announced that by 2035, no petrol, no diesel, and no hybrid cars will be allowed to be sold. This brought forward a previous deadline that last year they introduced a deadline for 2040 for that. Now, that covers 99% of all the cars that are on the road today. Only around 1% of the cars on the road in Britain are electric and would be allowed to be continued to sold beyond this. So they're pretty much announcing a complete revolution in transport. You know, by 2035, they want electric cars or potentially hydrogen fuel cell cars to be the norm. And I'm sure you can think for yourselves just what a massive change this would be for the UK. You know, you're starting to have to put out charging points outside everybody's houses. Presumably, you've got to have massive charging places in place of petrol stations for people to refuel. You've got to have massive investment. Car companies are saying they just can't produce the metals needed for batteries in quantities to make this happen. They need an additional, I think it was $50 billion invested in that.
Just for the batteries.
Just for the batteries. Yeah, it's a massive overhaul to the UK economy. And it's for climate change. It's, I think, the article that we've got to go up on Monday called it a moonshot. And it really is. This is a really pulling out all the stops effort to go away from petrol cars. And for what? Well, for global warming, to save the environment and to atone for our carbon sins, basically. And I think you can look at this. We're one small island, and changing all of this, I think, has little to no effect on global carbon emissions. But it shows just part of how this carbon emissions is a deadly deception. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had an article in the summer of 2017 called "What is the Paris Climate Change Really About?" And in there, he talked about how more and more this whole climate change movement is being used as an excuse to give more power to the government, to have a more socialist economy. And I think you see that kind of part of it. One of the subheads in that article, for example, is not about environment, but about control. But the other thing that he's talked about, and he had another article more recently called The Deadly Climate Change Delusion, and that was in the February 2018 time print edition, that, you know, the Bible is very clear about where weather disasters come from. And if you believe the Bible, you know, Nahum 1 and verse 3 says, the Lord has his way in the whirlwind and in the storm. There are countless scriptures that talk about God punishing through weather disasters. And so you have Britain now investing hugely in something that at the end of the day is a massive distraction from the real causes and the real sins that lead to this. So instead of Britain focusing energy on repenting, on turning to God, on fixing the problems that cause these curses, if they follow through on this and they don't just push, I imagine they'll end up delaying this repeatedly, but if they follow through on this, the energy, the enterprise, the biggest drive of the nation is going to be diverted into something that's just a complete waste, and worse than a waste, but that distracts from what we really need to be doing to fix the problem, returning to God.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. You would have expected it from Jeremy Corbyn. It's got to be a disappointment to have this coming from Boris Johnson. Nevertheless, we appreciate you bringing that to us. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of John Tudor: a rumor without a leg to stand on will get around some other way. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.